We are future gazing with The Economist and exploring its predictions for what might unfold this year and why. It is The World Ahead on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So there are journalists, along with more than a dozen leaders from business and politics, science and the arts. They weighed in on the 36th edition. It includes the future of work, the climate crunch, and we start with the theme pandemic to endemic. What do you think will be the biggest issues of 2022? Are you bullish or bearish on what lies ahead? It's 800-642-1234. Tom Standage is The Economist's deputy editor overseeing the World Ahead edition, where the magazine makes its annual predictions on the biggest issues of the year. Tom, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Hi. Well, it does seem obvious to start with the global pandemic. I don't know how it's for you in London or thereabouts, but here in Wisconsin, we're just getting hammered with COVID cases, infections critically high. And frankly, some Americans are really tired of rosy predictions and the storyline that if we can just get to X, then things will, you know, work out. What are your words for us on the pandemic front in 2022?
Well, the trajectory is, you know, we're not sure how long it's going to take, but the trajectory is pretty clear, which is that this is going to eventually turn into an endemic disease. So it's everywhere, but it's no longer posing a risk to people, provided they're vaccinated and have access to modern healthcare. And there are lots of diseases that fall into that category. Malaria would be another example. It's dangerous and kills a lot of people in the developing world, but if you live in a rich country, it's not something you have to worry about anymore. And, you know, a lot of places in the rich world are highly vaccinated, and even though they are having this a very large number of cases, record-breaking numbers of cases, the number of deaths has not risen very much at all, and that's because there is this large-scale protection that the vaccines have provided. So the picture may be, you know, the picture is, I understand, much patchier in the US because the there are some regions that are more vaccinated than others. But if people want this to go away, the best thing they can do about it is to get vaccinated, because ultimately that is, you know, the thing that protects you from disease and from death. It doesn't protect you from contracting the disease. Mm-hmm. But the signs are that Omicron is much more infectious, but does produce milder symptoms in vaccinated people. And so that means that potentially this is a step along the road towards this becoming an endemic disease. Now, that does require large-scale vaccination, and not just in rich countries where people have chosen not to be vaccinated. The other big problem is that in poorer countries, there are lots of people who would love to be vaccinated, but there aren't enough vaccines, or it's difficult to get the vaccines to them. Mm-hmm. And so that's the other area where I think we need to see progress in 2022. We are actually seeing a big increase in the production of vaccines, but it's difficult to vaccinate people in some parts of the developing world if you're using vaccines that need cold chains and things like that. So there is this sort of disparity between the degree of vaccination in poor countries and the degree of vaccination in rich countries that does need to be overcome. Because remember, Omicron emerged in South Africa and then mm-hmm. spread to the rest of the world very quickly. So if you don't have widespread vaccine coverage, then you are going to have the risk of these new variants breaking out, for a long time to come. So it's really important that that vaccine coverage is extended. And one of the things to watch out for later this year is trials being done on new vaccines that can be applied by skin patches or through inhalation. And I think, one of the reasons why people don't want to get vaccinated, there are some strange reasons why people don't want to get vaccinated, but one of them is a lot of people are simply afraid of needles. And I think if there were alternatives to receiving the vaccine through a needle, that might move the needle, as it were, and encourage more people to get the jab, well, to get the vaccine.
Well, wealthy countries keep stockpiling COVID vaccines. Looking at you, of course, United States buying it up. What will happen to low-income countries and the efforts of COVAX, the vaccine donation front, to get vaccines moving from rich countries to poor countries?
Yes, that is a problem. The fact that we are using these doses for boosters means that we have more of the doses that are being manufactured now going to rich countries than we were expecting. Or there were stockpiles that rich countries have that they were maybe going to give to poorer countries that they're now not going to, because we're talking about three or even four jabs For some people. So that does mean that although the production of vaccines is being ramped up very quickly, and you know we hope that we'll actually have a glut of vaccines by the end of 2022 globally, but the volume that's going to COVAX now is not large enough. The promises that have been made to COVAX have not been kept. The WHO has set this quite ambitious target of trying to get, I think, 70% of the 70% of the developed world with at least one jab by the middle of the year, and then to 100% by the end. I think that's a sort of deliberately ambitious goal. It's going to be 2023 before a lot of people in the developing world get a jab. So you know, we could be going faster on that, and the fact that we're using some of these doses for boosters has slowed down the access to vaccines in other parts of the world.
Tom Standage with us, deputy editor at The Economist. He's in charge of the World Ahead edition, where the magazine makes its annual predictions on the biggest issues of the new year. With your insights along the way at 800-642-1234. Staying on the pandemic theme for just one more moment here, President Biden announcing this week his administration would double its order of Pfizer's COVID antiviral pills, which has been, you know, shown to reduce hospitalizations. Very tight supply, very scarce. Could COVID antiviral pills be a precious commodity in 2022?
I think so. I mean, to be fair, there are plans to scale up production quite a lot, and the pills have been licensed in ways that should mean that it's possible to produce them in volume at quite low cost. I think the value of those pills is for people who test positive are in vulnerable groups. So they're not showing bad symptoms and they don't need to be hospitalized. You give them a course of these pills, they take them over a course of the week, and it dramatically reduces the likelihood that they need to be hospitalized by like 80 or 90%. So that means that you can then keep the pressure off the hospitals. And so this is not something that everyone is going to take, and it's not going to be, you know, oh, you've tested positive, take these just in case. There isn't going to be the volume of pills to do that. But I think for those vulnerable people who test positive but are not in immediate need of medical assistance, you can then ensure that they don't go on to develop serious illness or death. And I think that's a really useful new tool in the toolbox that we have in 2022 that we did not have in the first 2 years of the pandemic.
What will happen to vaccine passports, to vaccine requirements for social events, sporting events, eating out in restaurants, flying across the pond? I mean, what will happen to what we will have to show, or what the economy will want us to have in order to go to, as a gateway to doing these things?
Well, I think we're going to see a patchwork, and we're going to see these things come and go. And we've seen this in many countries have introduced these, you know, passports to if it's just for, say, nightclubs or just for particular kinds of venues. And then they relax the rules and then they retighten them. And I think, you know, waiting for a reality where waiting for the world to go back to 2019 is just not going to happen. The new normal is already here. This is what it looks like, which is rules changing all the time and unpredictability and also a much larger degree of friction when traveling. So if you're international travel now, you have to fill in all sorts of forms and get all sorts of tests. I don't see that going away for several years. It's rather like if you remember what happened after 9/11, all of these new rules came in about scanning stuff and taking your shoes off and not taking liquids onto plane, and they're still here 20 years later. And I think, you know, in that respect, these new barriers around travel and around doing other things are going to be with us for many years.
The Economist's deputy editor, Tom Standage, allowing us to peer into his crystal ball as to what key themes and events, trends could shape our year. What changes, what challenges do you see in the year ahead when it comes to politics here in America or globally? Are you optimistic about business, tech innovation, or worried about destabilizing forces like election meddling? We'll look globally. Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute, Tom Standage here on the Ideas Network. We're future gazing with The Economist on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning about the key trends and themes that may emerge in 2022. The World Ahead Edition, it's a collection of mini predictions that are grouped into 10 major themes. How do you feel about America on the world stage? The U.S. and Russian officials are expected to engage in bilateral diplomatic talks next week, addressing Russia's troop buildup along its border with Ukraine. Is U.S. and NATO influence building in 2022? How do you see U.S.-China relations changing this year? Join in 800-642-1234. The Economist's deputy editor, Tom Standage, edited the Global Trends to Watch in its 36th edition. He's with us for the hour. Tom, looking at the world stage, the pandemic aside, there will be a lot of political changes in the world. One issue is the rivalry between the U.S. and China. What do you expect to see there?
Well, the rivalry between the U.S. and China is both a rivalry between those countries, but it's also the rivalry between the system of democracy and the idea that actually democracy is dangerous and it's much better to have a sort of centralized autocratic government, which is what China does. And, you know, there are lots of other democracies, and you know, the US is considered to be, you know, the leader of the world's democracies. And meanwhile, there are other countries that sort of look to China and the Chinese model and say, well, maybe that's a better way of doing it. And so the rivalry is not just between the countries, it's between the systems. And I think that rivalry is going to be cast into very sharp relief at the end of this year, because we've got the midterms in the US, obviously. But around the same time, there's also the Communist Party Congress in China. And this is the point where, instead of having an election, normally Xi Jinping, the president, would be handing over to a new president. He's decided he doesn't want to, and he's going to be confirmed in power for at least another 5 years and possibly longer. But this sort of contrast between what the Chinese would say is a very sort of smooth, predictable thing that we all know that it's going to be Xi Jinping for the next few years, is going to be, you know, very different, they would say, from the sort of chaotic carnival of democracy that we will be seeing in America. And I think in particular, the prospect of a second term from Donald Trump and Donald Trump's influence over the midterms is exactly the sort of thing that the Chinese would point to and say, this is why democracy is dangerous. Not because they dislike his policies. They actually, I think, quite like having Donald Trump in the White House, because it makes America, in their eyes, a weaker adversary. But it's more that America's policy has whipsawed, that, you know, under Barack Obama, America was serious about supporting its foreign allies. It was serious about fighting climate change. Under Donald Trump, it did a U-turn on both of those things. Under Joe Biden, it's done a U-turn back again. And if Trump gets in again in 2024, the US will do another U-turn. And this sort of is a gift to the propagandists in China, because they'll say, how can you be a serious country if you keep changing your mind about these things? How can anyone take you seriously when you promise to do something, when you sign a treaty, when you form an alliance, if you just keep changing your mind? This is why democracy is bad and you shouldn't have it. And of course, if you're an autocratic leader somewhere else, like in Turkey or Russia or Hungary, then you say, yes, you're right, you know, democracy is bad and unpredictable, and America is a poor advert for its merits at the moment. So I think that's going to be the sort of in the background of these specific things happening in those countries. And the other thing to watch for is elections in other countries, so particularly France, Brazil and Hungary. In each of those cases, I think those elections and how well the populist autocratic figures running in those elections do will be taken as a sort of litmus test of the health of democracy more broadly, and whether there, you know, there is still enthusiasm for the sort of populist, autocratic, Trumpist sort of candidates that that we've seen in many countries in the past few years.
You know, you mentioned Trump, Trumpism and falsehoods, misinformation, disinformation. That has been such a huge issue here, especially with January 6th insurrection. So how do you see that unfolding and all of the falsehoods unfolding in this year?
Well, I don't think anyone's going to change their minds on any of this. I mean, that's the thing. I don't think, I mean, there's some very interesting material coming out of the January the 6th committee. But ultimately, we have reached the point where a lot of people in the Republican Party are more loyal to Trump than they are to the idea of democracy itself. And that's extremely perilous for America. But it's also very worrying, given that America is meant to be, you know, the sort of beacon of democracy for the rest of the world. And as I say, that is a gift to China and other countries who are saying, well, you know what, to their populations, democracy, you know, you don't want that. You want what we're giving you. We can keep society stable. We can protect you from COVID. We can ensure economic growth. At the end of the day, isn't that what you want? You know, this democracy business, it's too dangerous. And Donald Trump is the proof of that. So yes, that's extremely worrying. And I know that Joe Biden recently had his summit of democracies, and he's trying to rally democracies behind America, and he's trying to make democracy more resilient. But unfortunately, the fact is that America is a bad advertisement for democracy right now.
Another thing about China is that U.S. big tech has had a lot of difficulty with their platforms in China and essentially just going out. What do you see there going on in the tech industry and how that will play out with China in 2022?
Well, most of the big tech firms in the West, most of the big American ones, don't do much in China in the first place. So Facebook has never been allowed there. Twitter's never been allowed there. Google was there for a bit, but pulled out because it didn't want to censor itself, and so forth. Amazon is not there. So what's interesting is that the efforts to try and rein in the tech companies in America don't seem to have got very far. The tech companies keep on getting bigger and more profitable, and you know, occasionally they have to pay a fine or whatever, but it doesn't seem to make any difference. And one of the few things that Republicans and Democrats agree on is the need to take the tech firms down a peg or two and to bash them. The problem is, once you get into the detail, they have different objections to what the tech firms are doing and very different remedies. So I don't think we'll actually see much in the way of new legislation there. The one possible area where they might agree is on protecting children from harmful content. And that's something that, you know, everyone can get behind. You know, think of the children is always a way of getting bills passed. So we may see something on that. But yes, what's really striking is that in 2021, the action shifted to China. China cracked down on its big tech companies in a way that, let's be honest, American politicians would love to be able to do. I mean, Xi Jinping did things like he banned video games during the week for children. Now that's something you'd never be able to do in a democracy, but in an autocracy like China, you can do it. China has not approved any new video games since last July, and you need to have government approval to launch a game. 14,000 video game companies in China have gone bust as a result since then. He's also cracked down on lots of other things, you know, preventing companies from doing foreign IPOs. Didi, which is the Uber of China, was forced to unlist in America and is going to relist in Hong Kong or in mainland China and so forth. So there is this sort of extraordinary crackdown on tech happening in China. It's wiped $1.5 trillion off the valuation of Chinese tech companies. And what's happening is Xi Jinping, he wants to take the tech bosses down a peg or two. Some of them were getting a bit big for their boots. He also has this sort of moral campaign against what he thinks as rather frivolous things like video games. But his main interest is actually to steer the Chinese tech industry towards what he considers to be more valuable technologies. Things like artificial intelligence, semiconductors, quantum computing, things that will give China a long-term advantage in both business and in the military space. And he would like Chinese tech firms to be focusing on that instead of new kinds of shopping or ride hailing or video games. Now, whether this will work or not is unclear. What we're seeing is a lot less money flowing into Chinese startups now, and a lot more money flowing into American startups. You know, if you're a tech entrepreneur in China now, you really don't want to be having to second guess what the government is going to do tomorrow. So that has really changed the complexion of you know, how the Chinese tech industry is seen.
Uncertainty, and then I think yes.
Indeed. I think the other thing to watch out for this year is what happens in Europe. So Europe often ends up being the kind of de facto regulator for the world on things like data privacy, think of GDPR, or things like e-waste. So, you know, whether appliances are recyclable or not. There was a rule passed about that in Europe ages ago that meant that manufacturers of all kinds of goods said, well, if we're going to have to meet these standards in Europe, we might as well meet them globally. And so, you know, we're seeing European regulators basically sharpening their knives. And there's a new set of laws that are about to go through the Digital Markets Act in the EU. And that could actually pose more of a problem for American tech giants. It could force them to change the way they handle personal data for Europeans and thus for lots of people outside Europe. And it could also interfere with their ability to take over other companies. So we see, you know, Facebook trying to do a big takeover at the moment, Nvidia trying to do a big takeover at the moment. And European regulators are looking askance at that and saying, hang on a minute, are we sure this is the right thing, the right outcome in the long run? So I think the debate about what to do about big tech companies will continue, but it's interesting the way it's sort of the spotlight moves around the world in this way.
We're going to talk more about waste and even, you know, looking at the upcoming Winter Olympics here. Where do you see the Olympics as either a form of unifying, but also as a form of waste as well in building all of these structures?
Well, I'm not sure it's the waste. I mean, you know, the Olympics, hosting the Olympics has never been a good deal. And it's always claimed that it will lead to tourism and it will lead to, they'll make a profit. And it's always the same story, which is it always costs more than is expected. Mm-hmm. And they always build all these stadiums that don't end up being used for all the things that they said they'd be used for. And so there are fewer and fewer countries now that actually want to host the Olympics. And this is a problem because it means that the shortlist ends up being some quite unsavory places for many of these big sporting events. And we have a very good example of that this year. We have the Winter Olympics in China and we have the Football World Cup in Qatar. And in both cases, those host countries are being criticised for their human rights records, for using forced labour and so on. So I think it's a reminder that, yes, sport can bring us together, but it can also, these big events could be political footballs as well.
Deputy Editor from The Economist, Tom Standage, taking us through predictions for the new year, business, technology, culture, politics. We'll pick this up after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It is perhaps a roadmap for the new year. We're exploring The Economist's The World Ahead edition on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. A record number of workers quit their jobs in November, 4.5 million. That's from the new JOLTS report out this week from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. It's the latest indication that the job market is very hot for workers, perhaps the tightest labor market ever. What are workforce trends that will take hold in this climate? What is the future of remote work? Join in on the future of work, the future of the climate crisis, 800-642-1234. Tom Standage, deputy editor at The Economist, edited its annual The World Ahead series and with us for the hour. Let's bring on a caller now, Chris, joining us from Port Wing. Hi, Chris. What would you like to add?
Good morning. Happy New Year. I want to throw in a little bit of a shining light behind the gray clouds here. You know, we're going to see very rapid transition to renewable energy and the winding down of the fossil fuel industry in a way that people won't even believe. This dramatic cooperation that's going to have to go on globally to confront the climate crisis that we've caused is going to be trained for us by adapting to COVID, because we're starting to understand the global interconnectedness that is required for international positive change. And this is going to directly be affected by how we solve the COVID problem globally and then move on to climate change. And we're going to see friendly competition and the best practice sharing between nations, including the United States and China, which is going to allow for the drawdown of the nasty climate change gases. And we're going to see the redirection of the $8 trillion budget that the DOD has for the next 10 years, with spending directed to humanitarian aid projects, which they already do, and disaster relief projects, which they're going to be called to do more and more. But the primary news is that the economy is going to grow rapidly.
The green economy with renewables. Sure. I want Tom to jump in here on this movement away from fossil fuels and what you see, Tom, with the emergence of renewables and a greener economy.
Well, I'd love to be able to agree that the pandemic has been a dress rehearsal for global cooperation on big challenges, but unfortunately it hasn't. And if you look at what's happened, you've got rich countries basically stockpiling vaccines. You've got poor countries not having access to them in the quantities that they need. And you've got countries using vaccines for political ends. So China giving vaccines to other countries to sort of curry favour with them and so on. So I'm afraid it hasn't been the cooperation on the level we'd like it to have been. We're not even keeping our promises on COVAX with vaccines. So unfortunately, it's very similar in climate change. We have have this a goal that we can agree on, which is the Paris Agreement of trying to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. But if you look at what's happened in the last few months, we've got this short-term energy crunch. Prices of energy have shot up. Everyone's noticed the price of gas has gone up. The price of natural gas, which many countries, you know, rely on for heating and cooking, that shot up as well. In Britain, we've been turning old coal-fired power stations back on again during the Glasgow COP26 climate conference because we had a shortage of, because natural gas prices have quadrupled in Europe, and we rely very heavily on gas in this country for electricity. So we had to go back to coal. So this is really depressing, and it's exactly the wrong direction to be going in at a time when we're supposed to be fighting climate change. But it turns out that the reason, the way to deal with these short-term energy crunches and the way to deal with climate change are one and the same, which is to invest a lot more money in clean energy infrastructure. We need to be investing about $5 trillion a year around the world, and we're only investing a little bit over $2 trillion a year around the world. So we need to be pumping a lot more money into those renewable sources of energy. Controversially, we probably also need to be pumping more money into natural gas as a bridge fuel for countries that are very reliant on coal, like India and China. And we should also be putting more money into nuclear because it's producing, you know, carbon emission-free energy. But the fact is, we're not going fast enough. And I suppose the one, the where I would see a silver lining, two areas. One was that there was this agreement on the side of the COP26 event between China and America to try and find ways to cooperate. And, you know, China and America can cooperate on some things when they want to. Just think about how your iPhone is assembled. But they obviously disagree in many other areas. So how do we get climate into the camp of things that China and America are willing to work together on? But that was sort of a step in the right direction.
Well,
So that's a good sign. And then the other good sign is that the parties to COP26 have agreed to meet again for COP27 in Egypt in November. Normally, the year after a big climate conference, you get a smaller one. But this year, they're going to try and make it a medium-sized one. And we may get some sort of further pledges from countries about exactly how they're going to reduce their emissions. But I still think that, you know, we're not seeing enough action and enough cooperation on a global scale to deal with this problem.
Well, I want to slow that down a bit because our nation and most nations, frankly, have really waffled on climate actions. Paris Climate Accord, you mentioned, signed 6 years ago, signed by almost 200 nations. What movements or what action will happen on climate if accords are super loose and nations don't adhere to them?
Well, that's the problem. There isn't a way of enforcing any of this stuff. It all has to be done through cooperation. So one thing that would help would be a global carbon price, but it's hard to imagine how you could do that. So we do have a carbon market in Europe. The Chinese have recently introduced one, but it hasn't really got any teeth. And, you know, many countries, I mean, a step in the right direction is many countries have pledged to go to net zero emissions by the middle of the century. And America is now in that camp and, of course, has rejoined the Paris Agreement since Joe Biden became president. And the number of countries that have agreed to cut their emissions to net zero by the middle of the century now covers 90% of the world economy, up from 30% about 18 months ago. So that's a step in the right direction. But again, it's very easy for politicians to make these sorts of promises. I can promise all sorts of things are going to happen in 2050 because I'm not going to be here to see them, or I'm not going to be in office if I'm a politician. So that's really the difficulty. And I think we're starting to see sort of legal mechanisms being enforced here that in some cases countries are, or companies are being told that their future plans are actually, when countries make it the law that they're going to be net zero by 2050, you can then take action against companies that are essentially going to be violating that law because they're going to be emitting too much. So we may have to sort of have legal teeth put in, but that's going to be done on a country-by-country basis. There's no, you know, global way of ensuring that this happens. So yeah, there isn't an easy answer to this. It's very tricky.
Tom Standage is here, deputy editor at The Economist. He's in charge of the World Ahead edition, where the publication makes its annual predictions on the biggest issues of the new year and what might happen in science, in business, in politics, the pandemic, the list goes on. You can join in with your predictions for 2022, 800-642-1234. Tom, I want to look at the world of work, the future of work. Pandemic has prompted so many changes to the workforce, the knowledge workforce, working from home. What do you see unfolding in this year?
So we should remember that when we talk about working from home, only about 50% of people can work from home, even in the richest countries. So, it's very easy for people like me who have worked from home and for a long time, actually, even before the pandemic, I used to work at home quite a bit. It has been, it has been a different world. But I think ultimately, in the grand scheme of things, one of the longest long-term impacts of the pandemic is going to be changing the way that many people work. Not everybody, but the way that many people work. And in particular, this shift towards hybrid working, where information workers spend some of their time at home and some of their time in the office. And there's a general agreement that that's where we're going to end up. But there's a lot of room for disagreement about the details. Exactly how many days will you spend in the office or spend at home? Should you get to pick them? Should you have to go in on the same day as, other members of your team? And then there are also disparities between the willingness to go back to the office among women and among people of colour. They are less keen to go back into the office than white men are, for example. And that's very worrying, because we know that managers tend to favour people that they see in person, people that they interact with. This is an effect called presenteeism. And there's a lot of evidence that shows that, the more you sort of show up and basically are seen to be doing your job, the better you're likely to be perceived to be working, regardless of the actual outcome. So the danger is that the future of work and a hybrid workplace could actually be less fair, that companies could go backwards on the gender pay gap, they could go backwards on diversity and inclusion, if it turns out that white men are disproportionately more likely to go back to the office than women and people of colour. So the hybrid workplace needs to be, the rules around this and the way that procedures, the new rules that we build for this new workplace need to be thought about very carefully, because it will be less fair unless it's designed not to be. And then there's a whole load of other sort of details that need to be worked out. Is it okay for your boss to spy on you basically while you're working from home? Some companies use software that like counts whether you're moving the mouse or how many keystrokes you make. There's health and safety rules. There's tax considerations. We're seeing some states in the US suing each other because, if you've got all those bankers who notionally work in Manhattan, but they're actually, in New Jersey or they're living in a neighboring state, that state would like some of their income, please. And so, there are all sorts of details to be worked out. And I think it's going to take several years to work this stuff out. But that process really begins in earnest in 2022.
What about those frontline workers, the restaurant and bar workers, the retail workers, and the fight over a fair living minimum wage that we have seen go on in America? Will there be any movement there?
There is an extraordinary amount of movement there. I mean, we are seeing companies are having a great difficulty hiring people, because people don't want to do those sorts of low-paid jobs that may expose them to infection. Or even if they're not exposed to infection, they may have to, they may end up arguing with customers about whether they're wearing masks or whatever. And so there's a much less willingness to do those kinds of jobs. Also, if you worked in that kind of job and didn't like it, you now have a much wider choice of work, because if you can do some jobs remotely, which you couldn't do before, you may say, well, I actually would like to try and find another job where I don't have to do this. So we're seeing employers having to raise wages. We're seeing, minimum wages being put up across the board. And generally speaking, we are seeing that workers have more bargaining power than they have had for decades. Mm. This is an amazing, amazing change. It's great. It's a great time to be looking for a new job. And this is why we're seeing people resigning from their jobs in record numbers in America at the moment.
The Economist's deputy editor, Tom Standage, our guide to these themes, these events, trends that could shape 2022. He edited the World Ahead edition that is really chock full of predictions. Which predictions haven't we talked about in politics, in business, science, arts and culture? What are you keeping your eye on this year? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Tom Standage here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're reflecting this hour on The Economist's World Ahead edition with its editor, Tom Standage. It's 10 trends to watch in the coming year. I appreciated the commentary on canceling. The Economist gave us a laundry list, by no means exhaustive: unpaid internships, leaf blowers, in-person parent-teacher conferences. And how about this point? Some of the habits acquired during the pandemic are worth keeping. Canceling things is one of them. What do you think the history books will say about 2022, and who will have a pen and privilege to write that history? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Tom Standage with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's bring in Paula now in La Crosse. Hi, Paula. What are your observations?
Well, actually, on a personal note, I just retired. I was one of the November employees that left healthcare after 35 years. I was a clinical dietitian working with sick patients, mostly in the hospital. And just a comment that I'm kind of worried about, you know, the experience, and I'm not sure if you guys have talked about that, but the experience that us baby boomers have had in our employees, but I guess especially in healthcare. And I have to say, with taking care of COVID patients the last 2 years, it did kind of spur me to retire. I'm only 59, but so that was my concern. But on a happy note, I'm baking, which is my passion on a part-time basis, so it's fun.
Well, like baking on a part-time basis, meaning this might be a little side note or an encore career?
Well, maybe.
Okay. Keeping options open. Paula, thank you so much for sharing that. And Paula, really concerned that baby boomers and their institutional knowledge, that too is going away, Tom.
Yes, I can sympathize. My wife is a doctor in the National Health Service here, and she's spent most of this year injecting people. But it has been, you know, a very, very difficult time for frontline workers of all kinds, medics, as you know, first and foremost, but, you know, lots of other people that we rely on to deliver things, firefighters, teachers, and so on. So it's been very difficult. And I think one of the factors behind the great resignation that people are calling this sort of unprecedented level of people leaving their jobs is that there were people who, there's a sort of pent up number of people who were like, well, some people saying I've had enough of this, and other people saying I was going to quit before, but I felt a duty to stay in my role maybe a bit longer. And so you end up with this, you know, what we saw in the autumn of last year, suddenly sort of all sorts of people who might have left their jobs sooner decided that now was the time. Things felt like they were getting back to normal. And so, you know, that may be a factor. We're seeing an extraordinary number of people leaving healthcare and caring professions generally because they feel burnt out. And that is a real concern because, you know, it takes a long time to train replacements for them.
We're going to move to finance here with Keith in Appleton, who wants to bring up cryptocurrency. Keith, hi, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I'm curious as to what the cryptocurrencies, what you expect with those in the coming year or two, and especially you being the guest being from Europe, what viewpoint do they take of the cryptocurrencies over there?
Yes, Keith.
I don't think we have a particular European view on crypto. I think there is sort of, wherever you look in the world, there are people who think this is great and it's the future and we should all be, you know, putting our life savings into strange coins or NFTs or whatever. We are moderately skeptical about all of this, I would say, at The Economist. We think there's an interesting technology underneath it all that may turn into something. What we're seeing essentially at the moment is a sort of three-way fight over the digital future of money. And it's obvious that money and finance is going to be digitized. And there's one camp, the sort of the big tech companies, who have looked at what's happened in China, where the internet giants in China have built these payment systems that are very widely used now and are the sort of backbone of you know, much of the economy. And you know, Western firms would like to do the same, which is why Facebook has been trying to launch its own currency. So there's a sort of tech company view of this, and you know, you can pay for things with your Apple Watch and so on. And then you've got the blockchain DeFi crypto crowd who say, no, it's bad to have centralized big tech companies calling the shots. We've seen what's happened in other areas with that. It's much better for digital money to be decentralized and live on the blockchain. And then I think you've also got this phenomenon that the central banks are saying, well, hang on a minute, if we're going to have digital money, should it, rather than being decentralized on a blockchain or coming from a tech company, shouldn't it be coming from the central bank? And in fact, the country that's gone furthest down this path of issuing what are called central bank digital currencies or gov coins is China. These are not cryptocurrencies. They generally don't use blockchains, but they are essentially digital coins issued by the by the central bank, and this grants the central bank sort of superpowers. And so we've got this tussle between these three different visions about where money and where finance might go, and we are going to see different answers in different countries. We're seeing regulators taking different views, and it's ultimately regulators who are going to decide. So for example, in China, there's been a complete ban on crypto mining. In Singapore, meanwhile, they're much more open to crypto, and it's becoming a sort of crypto hub in Asia. Lots of people have moved there from China as a result, and in fact from other parts of the world. So Vitalik Buterin, the founder of Ethereum, which is, you know, probably the most interesting crypto coin, the number two after Bitcoin, he has moved to Singapore now. So I think, you know, this is something to keep an eye on this year. The question is, you know, how do you get the benefits of these, the interesting things these new technologies can do and that digital money can do without the risks and the drawbacks? And that's a difficult balancing act for regulators to figure out.
Keith, thank you for bringing in crypto. Let's go to space. How could space travel and space tourism change over this year?
So obviously we had a lot of space tourism in 2021 from SpaceX, from Blue Origin, from Virgin Galactic. All of those companies are going to be launching more tourists into space this year. And we should see that 2022 is the first year where more people go to space as paying passengers than as government employees, which is, you know, the way in which people have most frequently gone to space in the past.
But these are the uber wealthy people you're talking about.
Obviously this is mainly going to be uber wealthy people. But it's interesting that you've got this rivalry between them. You've also got the more traditional rivalry between the big powers. So China is going to be completing its space station, which is going to be permanently crewed from the end of the year. India is going to have another go at sending a robot space probe to the moon. Its last one didn't work, and so on. So there's that sort of thing happening too. But I think the real thing to watch this year is the new rocket from SpaceX, the Starship. It's easily the biggest rocket ever built. If it works, it will be, you know, an absolute game changer in the economics of space. And SpaceX has already transformed the economics of space once, but this would be extraordinary. It would be able to lift the entire Chinese space station in one go. It's currently being sent up in pieces. And that should make its first flight sometime in the first half of this year, probably, you know, April, May, something like that. But that could easily upstage everything else. And that could be the vehicle that takes the next American astronauts to the moon. It will probably, you know, be taking people to Mars by the end of this decade. So I think that's going to be the big news in space if it works. And, you know, when these things don't work, they fail really spectacularly. They're very expensive fireworks.
Your job is to analyze all this information and make these predictions. But what fills you with some hope? What makes you a bit optimistic about this year?
I think the thing I'm most optimistic about is the potential of technology to fix big problems. We talked about this a bit earlier on. I mean, the fact that the vaccines were created and rolled out so quickly, I mean, the actual underlying technology is decades old, but the fact that the vaccines were designed to combat this particular disease and then rolled out in such large numbers is, you know, a cause for celebration, even if we would like the vaccine rollout to be wider and more equitable. But I think it's a reminder that technology can step up. And what I would like to see is that happening in other areas where we have big problems. The obvious one, aside from health, is climate change. And so we have a section in the middle of the world ahead this year that looks at 22 emerging technologies to watch that might, because this is the thing, there's an old saying in the tech industry, it takes decades to create an overnight success. And that's what we saw with the mRNA vaccines, that this is something, that, an idea that people have been working on since the 1970s. And they appeared to sort of come from nowhere at the end of 2020. But in fact, it was a very long gestationary process. So what else is sort of bubbling under, what's brewing now that we might see breaking through? And it could be things like electric flying taxis. It could be 3D printed homes. It could be heat pumps. It could be direct air capture to suck carbon out of the air. There's all sorts of interesting technologies that could, you know, could change the world for the better. And primarily that means through improving people's health and through addressing climate change and the challenges of the energy transition. So I'm basically optimistic. I realize that technology is, you know, very often can be used for bad instead of good, but I'm optimistic about the power of innovation and the power of technology to deal with the big challenges that we face.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be watching and hopefully living it here in 2022. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Tom Standage, deputy editor at The Economist, in charge of the World Ahead edition. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.